All right, I'd like to call the Senate State of, I'm sorry, Joint Armed Services Committee to order. It is Wednesday, February 11th. The time's now 17:32. We are in the Senate Finance Committee room in Juneau, Alaska. And today is, the time, 17:30. Okay, here we are. We have members present, co-chair, Representative Gray. We have Senator Wilikowski, Senator Merrick, Senator Dunbar, Senator Rauscher, Representative Dibert, Representative Holland, Representative Nelson, Representative Stutz is excused, and myself, Chair Kawasaki. I'd like to thank Marilyn Kawakami from Senate Records, as well as Susan Quigley, the moderator with the Legislative Information Office today. We have several things on the agenda, and I know that everybody else has potentially some other things to be at, so we're going to try to speed through these as most efficiently as we can. We have five people who volunteered to be on the agenda, and we thank them all in advance for being here. First, I will just go right into the presentation. We have Dan Maurer. He's an associate professor of law at Ohio Northern University. He has a presentation on civil disturbances procedure. He will be talking a little bit about civil disturbance procedures. Dan teaches at the National Security Law, Criminal Law, White Collar Crime, Military Justice, and Criminal Procedure at Ohio Northern University, Pettit College of Law. His research and scholarship focuses on the intersections of military criminal law, congressional and presidential war powers, the law of armed conflict, and civil-military relationships, with publications in the Harvard National Security Journal and the Journal of National Security Law and Policy, among others. He has appeared multiple times on MSN, MS Now, CNN, and NPR, and has been quoted in national and international media, including the LA Times, New York Times, The Atlantic, BBC, The Economist, and CBS. And he is online right now and joining us, I believe. Professor Maurer, can you hear us?
Can you hear me?
We sure can. If you would just like to state your name and your affiliation for the record and then add anything you'd like to your biography, we're just pleased to have you here.
Dan Maurer, Associate Professor of Law at Ohio Northern University. And I would just add that I'm a retired Army Lieutenant Colonel, a former Combat Engineer Officer, and mostly a former JAG Officer, Military Marine.
Great, thank you. And you have a presentation for us.
Not exactly. I was under the impression I was really answering questions that you all had about the 11th Infantry Division.
Okay, we are, stumbling through this a little bit, Professor Maurer, but we actually do have some questions by the co-chair, House co-chair, Representative Andrew Gray.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kawasaki. Mr. Maurer, thank you so much for being here. I'd like to start off by talking about at the end of January, we know that all the National Guard troops on Title 10 orders that had been deployed to Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland had been withdrawn. However, those on Title 32 orders to Memphis and New Orleans are still deployed. Can you explain the difference between Title 10 and Title 32 orders?
Sure. The simple distinction is under Title 10, troops are under the command and control of the President and Secretary of Defense. Under Title 32, they may be performing a federal mission at the request of the President or Secretary of Defense, but they remain under the command and control of the state governor. The state governor is essentially the commander-in-chief of that state guard force. So under Title 32, they are still state employees. They're still getting paid by the state as guard members, but performing perhaps a federal mission at the request of the President, but still under the control of the governor.
Follow-up. And Representative Gray, you can just continue on.
Thank you. So I'm going to follow up on that because you just mentioned that Title 32 should be paid for by the state. However, in the case of Memphis and New Orleans, these Republican governors got special permission from the White House to receive federal funds to pay for the deployment, even though they were on Title 32 orders. Is that a common occurrence?
Honestly, I don't know. I'm not an expert in National Guard deployments, to be completely frank with you. Having spent my entire career on active duty. But I can tell you that the deployment under Title 32 is generally not for the purposes that they're currently deployed to do. This kind of quasi-support to law enforcement is an unusual deployment when it's at the request of the federal government. Typically, National Guard, as you know, are used for state, national, or natural disaster emergency responses, and often to backfill active duty when active duty deploys, or even to deploy overseas themselves under Title 10 orders. So keeping the troops under Title 32 in this kind of strange hybrid under the direction of the governor, but also really working for a policy objective of the president is slightly unusual.
Thank you. And I'll follow up on that, just speaking specifically of the Title 10 orders that were about Los Angeles, Chicago, and Portland. Randy Manner, who is the retired Army two-star general and former acting vice chief of the National Guard, said that those deployments were 100% ineffective in doing what Trump wanted them to do due to the fact that they couldn't be used the way he wanted to use them. Can you just expand a little bit on that?
Sure. It seems like... Well, according to President Trump and Secretary Hegseth, these troops were there to provide support, quote-unquote support, to ICE, conducting law enforcement, i.e. immigration law enforcement, in and around Los Angeles. The thought was, certainly in response to the civil disturbances, protests, and in some cases violent unrest, the thought was ICE can't protect itself. The civilian presence on the ground was going to interfere with their operations, present a security threat to ICE members, and make it harder for them to conduct their raids. Hence, let's deploy the military, in this case, the California Army National Guard and active duty Marines. Their purpose, ostensibly, was to provide security for ICE. Now, that is a way to avoid the restrictions of the Posse Comitatus Act, which is a federal law that basically prohibits the active duty military and all of its branches from performing law enforcement domestically, absent a direction from Congress, like through the Insurrection Act. If the president invokes the Insurrection Act, that's a workaround. But here, by simply saying that they support law enforcement, kind of providing an outer perimeter around various places where the ICE agents were gonna conduct their raids, or protecting federal business or federal government facilities in and around Los Angeles, they were essentially not performing quote-unquote law enforcement, not per se law enforcement. In reality, what they're doing is enabling law enforcement to do their job by keeping civilians away from ICE agents. That is, in effect, law enforcement. And a federal district judge in California essentially said that many of the missions that those guard members were assigned to do were, in fact, violating the Posse Comitatus Act. As you noted, those troops have since left and have stopped doing those missions. But the concern that was raised to the litigation over the course of the summer, both in Los Angeles and in Portland and then in Chicago, was the danger that you'd have guard forces and or active duty forces performing a law enforcement function despite state and local authorities disclaiming the need for that additional law enforcement support. So what it looked like, in essence, was a muscular additional show of force by the federal government to back up ICE, knowing that ICE was engaging in very controversial tactics and missions and likely to face civilian protest. Let's put uniformed troops out there as a kind of a screening mechanism, as a block, as a protective perimeter of sorts. So that was essentially the controversy involving the deployment of those troops to LA. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Maurer. And I'm just going to let the co-chair and the committee know I have one more question, then we'll open up and move on. But I want to speak specifically about Alaska. We had heard that one thing we haven't talked about is the 2,500 troops, National Guard troops, that are still deployed to Washington, D.C. We learned a couple of months ago that there was 100 Alaska National Guard troops that were had been basically requested for the D.C. deployment this spring. Co-Chair Kawasaki and I received an email from the liaison, the DMV liaison, Angela LaFlamme, letting us know that although that there hasn't been an official request and they have nothing official to report, that that's still something that could be possible. And so I wondered if you could talk about how Washington, D.C. is different than other states in terms of having National Guard troops there, if you can? And if not, we can always, I can bring that question up to Ms. Stock when she's been introduced.
Yeah, basically, the National Guard in D.C., D.C. is not a state, so there's no governor in charge of that guard. Instead, it's the president. So while the president is the commander-in-chief of the active duty, the president is also the commander-in-chief of the D.C. National Guard. And when they, based on how they're structured and their legal authority granted by Congress, they can, in effect, perform law enforcement functions in D.C. as if they were like the California Guard under the command and control of Governor Newsom, ordered to do law enforcement. The governor can do that under state authority. In the same way, the president, kind of acting like a governor, quote unquote, can order the D.C. Guard to perform law enforcement type functions in D.C. itself. Now, in 2020, there was during the civil unrest following the George Floyd murder in Minneapolis, civil unrest across the country, and in particular in D.C., President Trump floated the idea, among other things, of invoking the Insurrection Act, which he did not do, but also requesting the support from other states, have their states deploy National Guard troops to D.C. to augment the D.C. force. That, in fact, happened. I can't recall off the top of my head how many states provided forces or how many there were on the ground, but that was at the essentially the consent of those state governors, which they're free to do. To my knowledge, no state has ever been in the position where their National Guard has been forcibly taken, essentially taken from the state, and deployed to a domestic civil disturbance against the consent of the state's governor in another state. That, to my knowledge, has never happened. The fact that they were used against the wishes of Governor Newsom in California itself was novel. To my knowledge, that had never happened before. So D.C. is a unique kind of a one-off situation. The president's use of the D.C. Guard in D.C. to do what they're doing right now is lawful until Congress says they're going to change the law. So does that answer that question?
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you. Dr. Maurer, can I, let's see, we had Representative Nelson next.
Okay, you're cool. Thank you, Professor Maurer. Mainly, my question revolves around the difference between Title 10 and Title 32. Can you speak on when the Posse Comitatus Act falls into effect for soldiers under Title 10 and when it falls into effect for Title 32? Because I know there are some differences of when that comes into effect.
Yeah, sure. So Posse Comitatus Act, 18 U.S.C. 1385, is a law that goes back to basically right after the Civil War during the Reconstruction era. And what it amounts to, again, is a prohibition on the use of active duty troops, so normal federal troops under Title 10 authority, to perform law enforcement, the actual language from the text of the statute is execution of the law. And that has been interpreted by courts over the years to mean things like making arrests, and providing kind of routine, regular intel sharing with law enforcement operations, providing kind of direct material support, planning with local law enforcement. That constitutes execution of the law. So not just making arrests and conducting patrols, but also this other kind of, you know, background detective work type support might constitute law enforcement. And unlike other countries, including many of our allies and partners, we do not use our federal military to do law enforcement. We have very robust federal law enforcement, the FBI, and something like 20 or 25,000 different law enforcement agencies around the country at the local, city, municipal, county level. That's our first line of defense, and usually the only line of defense. So this act is there as a basic bar. It does not bar troops that are working under Title 32, which is state control. Now, Alaska or Minnesota or Maryland or Delaware or New Hampshire, Texas, they can all enact laws if they wanted to that would prevent the governor of those states from using the guard to do law enforcement. To my knowledge, no state does that. to my knowledge, no state has their own kind of posse comitatus. I could be wrong about that, so I acknowledge that. But for the most part, I think most states, if not all states, do permit their guard forces to be used in a law enforcement capacity at the direction of the governor or at the direction of the state legislature. So Title 32 is essentially, it does not apply. It just doesn't work. It has no bearing whatsoever with regard to the Posse Comitatus Act.
Follow
up? Go ahead.
Thank you. Professor Maurer, that is interesting to hear, especially when it comes to Title 32, just because I know of personal experience some of the drug enforcement and riot control that Title 32 soldiers participate in. Can you talk a little bit about when, say, during the global war on terror, when the president and governors offered up for deployment some National Guard soldiers for rotation, and what that kind of Title 10, Title 32 relationship looked like?
Yeah, well, essentially that's just putting Title 32 National Guard soldiers on Title 10 orders. And they become part of the normal operating federal chain of command. They fall under an active duty unit headquarters that ultimately reports to the Secretary of Defense and the President. They're essentially just another active duty unit when they're put on Title 10 orders for whatever duration they are. They're still a guard unit, but being activated makes them subject to the command and control and the authority of the President and the Title 10 law, to include the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which would not apply to state guard forces conducting state missions, unless the state has its own kind of Uniform Code of Military Justice.
One more.
Yep.
Thank
Please.
You. Professor Maurer, no, I appreciate that. But at the end of the day, regardless if you're under Title 10 or Title 32, whoever is currently the head of the executive branch still is the commander-in-chief and still in charge of their direction, correct?
Well, if troops are still under Title 32, they are not under the command and control of the Chief Executive of the United States. They're under the command and control of the Chief Executive of the state, and that's it. The only way they can come under the command and control of the President is if they are literally put on active duty orders, either because the state volunteers them to be and offers them up at the request of the President, or the President orders them, which he has the authority to do, or Congress has the authority to do that. It's very rare, but it happens.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Professor. We now have another question from Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Maurer, for being here. This might be jumping ahead in the presentation, but I am interested in your perspective on the Insurrection Act and there was a time when the President Trump was talking about using the Insurrection Act to send forces to Minnesota. He's since backed off of that. But can you talk a little bit about the way the Insurrection Act sort of overrides Posse Comitatus and the status that people are in, and when historically the Insurrection Act has been appropriately used?
Yeah, so you're right to say that President Trump has not frequently, but has from time to time threatened to use the Insurrection Act in various places, Minnesota being one of them, Baltimore being another, Memphis being another, Chicago being another, Portland, Los Angeles, and that's just in this first year of his second term. He has not invoked it, and frankly, that has come as a surprise to many observers, given the frequency with which he threatens it. And if he were to do so, he is acting within the letter of the law. Whether he should use it is a different question. That's a policy question, not a legal question. If he uses it, arguably he's acting within the scope of the law. The law is very broadly written. Again, it goes back to it goes back well before the Posse Comitatus Act, the precursor to the Insurrection Act. Has its origin at the time of the Revolution. Goes that far back. And it essentially works as an exception to the Posse Comitatus Act, because the Posse Comitatus Act says shall not be used to execute the law unless the Constitution or another act of Congress permits it. Well, the Insurrection Act is an act of Congress that permits it. Now, to use the Insurrection Act, the president has to follow certain procedures. They're pretty vague, and they're fairly easy to meet. You can look at Title 10 U.S. Code, Sections 251 to 255. In order to invoke it, he has to first issue a proclamation saying he's doing it and why, and he has to give the people that he's concerned about, the threat, a chance to back down before he deploys anybody or before he uses military force in that way. But once he does that, he has an extraordinary amount of discretion under the statute to use the amount of force to quell the civil disturbance, quell the riot, quell the rebellion, or quell the insurrection as he sees fit. Those terms, like rebellion and insurrection and domestic unrest, are not defined in the statute, which means, in essence, the president gets to define them. The president gets to determine when those triggers are met, when those predicates are met, allowing him to say, I'm going to invoke the Insurrection Act now. Now, there is a movement. Movement is maybe too much of a word here, but there is routinely effort to lobby Congress to amend the Insurrection Act, really since Trump started threatening to use it in his first term. There's a very common recognition that there are gaps in this law that may be worth filling, maybe making it harder to invoke. Again, he hasn't invoked it. When it has been invoked, it hasn't really been controversial in a really negative way. So, for example, in 1992 was the last time it was invoked in the LA riots. So, following the Rodney King beating and the acquittal of the police officers, riots ensued, lots of property damage across LA, people hurt, people killed. The state government and the city government requested support from then President George H.W. Bush. And we need federal troops to come here and help us put down this civil unrest. We cannot handle it ourselves. That is allowed under the Insurrection Act. The state can request that support, and the president can give that support. He invoked the Insurrection Act, troops deployed, and then troops conducted kind of both routine and exceptional law enforcement operations in and around LA in 1992. Prior to that, it was used several cities in the 1960s in civil unrest, civil rights unrest. I want to say Detroit was one of them. But notably, in 1957, President Eisenhower deployed the 101st Airborne Division from Fort Campbell, Kentucky, 1,000 troops from Fort Campbell to Little Rock to essentially protect the Little Rock Nine trying to go to school when the Arkansas state government refused to honor and acknowledge the desegregation order from the Supreme Court. So the state governor had essentially deployed his state National Guard in a way that was essentially promoting or inciting violence and protecting those who were threatening the kids. President Eisenhower federalized the Arkansas Guard, which he's permitted to do, ordered them to stand down, and deployed the active duty troops from the 101st to provide that essential law enforcement and protection to those kids going to school, to enforce the desegregation order. So that's a laudable example of when the Insurrection Act has been used. And really, unless you were in Arkansas, you didn't have a whole lot of complaint about it. What President Trump seems to be suggesting now with claims to or threats to use the Insurrection Act are novel, claiming that, for example, there's a rebellion in Los Angeles when even a very liberal reading of civil unrest and violence would not meet the definition of rebellion in any normal definition of rebellion. To quell the invasion of illegal immigrants, quote unquote, the insurrection in Portland or in Chicago, right? These terms were used, legal terms were used to suggest that the conditions were ripe for him to deploy the troops under the Insurrection Act. The problem is those terms aren't defined by the statute, which again means the president can define them however he wants until a court steps in and defines them or the statute defines them. and he's been threatened to use them in a context of pushing back on civil unrest and civil protest against another branch of the federal government enforcing federal law that in itself is very controversial, and then those tactics that they're using are very controversial. So it's an unusual situation. I dare say it's an unprecedented situation, certainly given the frequency and number of times he has threatened to use the Insurrection Act and then not used it.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Maurer. We're going to move on to the next speaker. The next speaker actually does have an experience in civil disturbance procedures, and that is Margaret Stock. She's a retired lieutenant colonel in the military police, U.S. Army Reserve. Margaret has extensive experience with U.S. military issues. She's also worked as a professor at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, as an adjunct, and as an adjunct instructor at the University of Alaska. Margaret has served on the board of the Federal Bar Association's Immigration Law Section and is a former member of the American Bar Association's Commission on Immigration. In 2013, she was named a MacArthur Foundation Fellow, which is also known as the Genius Grant. We wanted to welcome Margaret, if you'd like to maybe introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Margaret Stock. I know some of you from my long period of residence here in Alaska. And at one point, a little fun fact, I was in charge of law enforcement operations at Fort Richardson, now known as J-Bear. And one of my duties was to train my troops on potential civil disturbances, but luckily we didn't have very many back then, so we didn't have to use the training that we had very often. Anchorage is pretty tame, in other words.
It certainly is. I guess I'll just start off with some questions and then open it up to the group. I guess the first question is, can you explain the purpose of Army Field Manual FM3-19.15 and the regulations within that section concerning the use of military force and civil disturbances, since we've been just chatting about that and its application?
Sure. So I believe I provided the link to the manual to folks on the committee. But basically, this is the doctrine that lays out how the military, in particular the Army, is supposed to provide support and assist civilian law enforcement authorities when there's a civil disturbance. And it's a big, fat manual, but it's pretty interesting. It does have a layperson's version of the Posse Comitatus Act in the back. If you look at the Appendix B about law enforcement activity, it tells you exactly what the official doctrine is regarding the Posse Comitatus Act to a layperson, not to a lawyer. It's laid out pretty clearly. And it also has some interesting sections that earlier in the manual that talk about what the military's role is when there's a civil disturbance or protest going on. And I'd just like to point out a couple of the interesting pieces of doctrine in there. One of them is that working relationships between commanders and protest group leaders are increasingly seen as the best means for preventing bad outcomes in crowd control situations. This is called the negotiated management model of crowd control. Law enforcement activities in large metropolitan cities in the US and Europe practice it. And the manual further talks about open dialogue between protest leaders and military commanders, that's the best way to keep things under control. Manual talks about that people have the right to protest, and especially in America, we have constitutional rights, and that commanders are supposed to make a concerted effort to win over demonstration leaders and work with them and allow them to conduct their protest in an acceptable manner. The manual further goes on to emphasize that winning in combat is completely different from winning in a civil disturbance situation. They are not the same, and that winning in the environment of a civil disturbance situation is about seizing and holding the moral high ground, following the law. The manual points to the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department inviting the media in to accompany their tactical commander during crowd control situations to show that they have nothing to hide. So this is basically the top thinkers in the American military putting together the doctrine for how to handle civil disturbances. And of course, it's a very thick manual, but it's one that I was trained on and its predecessor publications when I was a military police officer on active duty and in the reserves. I would comment just at the end of discussion of the manual that it doesn't seem to be what's been happening most recently in some situations in our country. The doctrine that I was trained on does not seem to be the doctrine that ICE is using. They seem to have a completely different approach to the problem of civil disturbances. And again, this is what the experts say you should do, and they don't seem to have been trained necessarily on this valuable doctrine. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stock. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kawasaki. And thank you, Ms. Stock. I want to just point out that in the email that Co-Chair Kawasaki and I received from Angela LaFlamme, she pointed, I had asked about the five Alaska Guard soldiers that had been assigned to ICE in Anchorage. And she corrected me that that number has been increased to six. The six National Guard soldiers assigned to ICE in Anchorage are only performing administrative tasks. I am going to make a comment before I ask my question to Ms. Stock. My comment is that in 2016, the budget for the country for ICE was $6 billion. Today, they have $85 billion to spend. And when I interviewed Senator Lisa Murkowski for my podcast, this is publicly available, I asked her about this. And what she said, in no uncertain terms, is ICE has more than enough money. They don't need any help. So I guess I'm just putting that on the record, that ICE doesn't need National Guard help to do administrative tasks. But having said that, Ms. Stock, under what circumstances would National Guard soldiers, and I would imagine, you know, if you were in charge of military police at J-Bear and you had an ask for six of your folks to go help ICE, what would be governing their behavior and what they could and couldn't do?
Well, again, Professor Maurer, I believe, talked about the difference between Title 10 and Title 32, and I concur with what he said, so there's no need to repeat it. But basically, with regard to the National Guard helping ICE, I'm not sure what they're doing, so it could be perfectly fine activities. Maybe they're helping with computer technology or something in the background. I'm not aware that they're going out on the street and grabbing people. But the issue here with the Posse Comitatus Act is that even if the president invokes the Insurrection Act, the troops can't violate the Constitution. So the Fourth Amendment still applies, the Fifth Amendment still applies, the Sixth Amendment still applies, all those laws still apply. I have the sense somehow that some people in the political sphere these days think somehow that they can just violate the Constitution if they invoke the Posse Comitatus Act or the Insurrection Act, but that's not how it works. You still can't violate the Constitution. So if you're going to use National Guard and active duty troops to do any kind of law enforcement, you have to make sure they're trained and they know what they're doing. And I've experienced this in the military police. One of the problems we had in the military police was that there's two legal regimes out there if you're in the military. There's the law of war, which the regular troops get trained on, fighting, who you're allowed to kill, when you're allowed to use your weapon, what the use of force is. And then there's law enforcement law, which is completely different. And so as a military police officer, I had to have this switch on in my head and go, wait a minute, am I in combat? I'm allowed to do certain things in combat. Or am I doing law enforcement? Because if I'm doing law enforcement, it's completely different. And you have to follow different, completely different rules. So you have to be able to switch off the law of war in your head and turn to the domestic law, law enforcement law. And that's hard to do. And active duty troops generally don't get trained in how to do law enforcement. National Guard, they get a lot more training in civil disturbance, is my understanding and my observation. But the active duty troops generally don't get a lot of this kind of training, and you have to do a lot of reorientation. You have to spend a lot of time training people to think differently when they're performing law enforcement duties.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Stock. Representative Nelson.
Thank you. Ms. Stock, you know, it's been a while since I've been out to Fort Leonard Wood and read the MP doctrine, but can you talk about what happens when the protest expands past an acceptable manner, you know, the escalation of violence that could occur and how an MP matches that, and then also how de-escalation of violence and the MP is supposed to match that.
Right. Well, the manual does talk about that, and what you're supposed to do is de-escalate the situation. And in my experience, when we had a situation involving a protest, our objective was to tell the protesters, it's great to protest, but you got to stay in this area. You can't you know, come onto the base. You can protest at the front gate, but you can't block the front gate, you know. And if you block the front gate so that people can't come in and out of the area, we're not going to let you do that. You know, that'd be violating the rules. But if you protest off to the side of the front gate, that's okay. You know, you just can't impede the traffic, and you have to let the military do its duty. Generally, you don't get protests on bases because they're not prohibited. They're prohibited. The commander just won't let somebody come onto a base to mount a protest. So they have to protest off the base, outside the front gate, that sort of thing. But generally speaking, we were trained to de-escalate the situation, and part of that is what I talked about earlier. You know, if somebody wants to protest, it's your right in America under the First Amendment to protest. And that's part of a healthy democracy, that people are out protesting. The right of the people to tell their leadership what they think is going on, what's wrong, and to hold up signs. And we were trained that, you know, people are going to call you names and they might spit on you, but you got to just take it like an MP. You know, you don't hit them back because they spit on you or they called you a dirty name or something. You don't escalate the situation and you don't overreact. And it is the right of the American people to protest.
Go ahead and continue.
Thank you. And I appreciate that, Ms. Stock. What I'm talking about mainly is the escalation of violence when it comes to protesters, how the MPs are supposed to react, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, they are supposed to de-escalate it, but sometimes a protest turns into a mob or unruly crowd and things start getting thrown, and MPs have to react to that. So can you talk about the doctrine that
Absolutely.
Goes into that escalation
sure.
of violence?
That's one of the reasons why I gave you the manual, because the manual addresses that, and it has examples of the equipment that the MPs use and when to use it. You know, we had certain types of special helmets, we had batons, we had shields, we were taught different formations that we could use to prevent people from getting killed. We were taught not to spray riot control agents in people's faces, you know, use it to move a crowd back, but don't harm anybody directly. You don't spray somebody right in the eyes with a riot control agent. We were taught the formations necessary to move a crowd back and get them into the right area and contain them and maybe disperse them peacefully. And again, I know that your time is short, but the manual is really thick and it has all kinds of cool diagrams in it and examples and pictures, and it shows you exactly how to do this. And that's one of the reasons why we train so much. We would spend a lot of time actually putting on our gear and standing in formation and practicing, and we'd have fake mobs, you know, to work with. We would hire military personnel on the base to pretend to be a mob and behave badly so we could decide how we're going to handle it. But it's a lot of training, and you have to trust the training, too. You can't just send somebody who's not trained out on the street. They're going to overreact.
Yeah, thank you. And being a part of some of those exercises, it is quite interesting to see from both sides. But You do understand that doctrine does also call for some arrest if agitators are caught
yes.
under that guise.
Absolutely. But primarily what the military's role is to let the civilians step in, the civilian law enforcement authorities step in and try to do that, unless it's actually happening on a base, you know, in which case we as the military police could arrest civilians. But we would have to apply the rule that applies to arresting civilians to the civilians and different rules to people who are serving in the military. And of course, there's differences there. Article 31 rights versus Miranda rights, which people have to understand. So it's getting into the weeds here on the legal stuff, but you have to be really smart and know the law in order to do it correctly. Or you end up with convictions being thrown out because you violated the Constitution when you arrested somebody, and their sharp defense lawyers come in and raise the Posse Comitatus Act as a defense and say that you violated it or you violated the Constitution. So if you want to get a conviction after you arrest somebody, you got to do it correctly. You know, and I learned that as a military police officer, to go by the book, and then the conviction would hold up in court. And if I didn't go by the book, I was going to end up in trouble, get counseled, and the conviction would get thrown out.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lieutenant Colonel Stock, for being here tonight. It seems like we're only allowing Lieutenant Colonels to testify, which is good. So the Secretary of Defense at one point last year referred to the rules of engagement as, quote, stupid. But you had alluded to the fact that it's not the rules of engagement that apply in domestic in DISCA operations, right? It's the rules of use of force. And so I don't know if you are aware of, I'm not aware of any similar statements about the rules of use of force, and I wonder if you could speak to that difference a little bit more. And then also, you know, if a soldier or a Marine or whomever, but let's assume it's a soldier, is given an unlawful order to violate the constitutional rights of a protester, what duty, if any, do they have with regards to that unlawful order, and are the duties different with enlisted versus officers?
Okay, so there's a lot of questions in there. I will note that the term rules of engagement, you can write rules of engagement for a civil disturbance too. But the JAGs generally, and I think you know this because I think you had some involvement in it, before an operation, there's supposed to be a lot of planning, and part of the planning for the operation is to write the rules of engagement for that particular operation, whatever they're going to be, and communicate them to the troops on the ground. And sometimes even we were given a little card and said, we were told, you know, this particular operation, these are going to be the rules of engagement for this operation. It's completely different from when you were in Iraq. Wake up, you know, it's not what you were doing over there. This is a new, different kind of operation, and these are the rules here. So just to clarify on that, but your question about unlawful orders, I've frankly been puzzled by the national dialogue on this because I was taught repeatedly as a military officer in my basic training, my military police basic training, that it's your duty not to follow unlawful orders. And that was just pounded into my head, you know, that at some point in your career, Lieutenant Stock, you're going to be given an unlawful order and you got to disregard it. You got to say, sir, that order is unlawful. And they said this over and over and over again in training. And they gave us examples from the Vietnam War of Lieutenant, you know, war crimes that were committed by U.S. forces and how the brave helicopter pilot came in and stopped the U.S. forces from murdering the civilians and who were, the military was committing war crimes over Lieutenant Callie, and you know the whole story. I think you've had the same training that I have. But it was repeated over and over again. So when I heard people saying this publicly, you're not supposed to obey unlawful orders, I thought, yeah, no kidding. You know, that's what I've been told my whole entire career. Enlisted soldiers are supposed to be trained the same way. However, the training is a little bit different because officers obviously have more leadership responsibility to, you know, direct troops what to do. And enlisted soldiers can potentially face a court-martial, you know, for not following lawful orders. So that sometimes they have a hard time figuring out whether it's a lawful order or whether they should just do what they're told. So officers probably bear more responsibility as a legal matter to make sure that they're giving orders that are lawful in order to prevent the enlisted soldiers from going to jail for following unlawful orders. And of course, officers have more recourse to JAGs who can tell them whether an order is lawful or not and give them legal opinions. It's very hard for an enlisted soldier to go find a JAG officer when he's on the battlefield and there's no JAGs around to tell him whether the order to take care of the prisoners was lawful or not. So I think there's a little more leeway in the sense that enlisted soldiers aren't expected to exercise their judgment as much. But definitely on the officer corps, there's a lot of training on this. And when I was at West Point teaching on the faculty there for over 9 years, there was just a tremendous amount of training on this and lectures, and people were brought in to talk about what the difference is between a lawful order and an unlawful order.
Thank you. And just as a note, in the Judge Advocate Legal Center and School in Charlottesville, Virginia, there is a display specifically about My Lai and about exactly the case that you raise. It is one of the paradigmatic examples. Thank you for that answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Stock. And before we go to Co-Chair Gray, I know that, Mr. Maurer, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Great. I'm sorry. I just wanted to add on. I don't disagree with anything that Ms. Stock has said. I agree 100%. I would just add, I've done a lot of writing and talking about the unlawful order issue in the last 3 or 4 months with regard to the boat strikes in the Caribbean and the Eastern Pacific, with regard to potential invasions of Greenland. I'm part of a group called the Former JAG Working Group, which consists of, you guessed it, former JAGs, many retired, many senior DOD retired counsel, and this issue of unlawful orders is a daily discussion point. It's it's challenging, notwithstanding the fact that you're drilled on disobey an unlawful order, disobey an unlawful order, disobey an unlawful order. The challenge, of course, is figuring out, well, other than the My Lai incident, what is an unlawful order, right? You know, ordering a troop to take a prisoner out back and execute them is pretty patently, obviously, clearly unlawful. Is an order to a private in Los Angeles to detain a civilian protester for 45 minutes, does that violate the Posse Comitatus Act, which is a criminal statute? Is that unlawful order? Would that private know that? Would the company commander know that? Would the division commander know that? Probably not. Probably not. So it really does become a matter of context and circumstance and what exactly is the order to do. And Ms. Stock was correct in saying that when a service member, whether it's an officer or enlisted, obeys an order that itself is unlawful and they end up committing a crime as a result, they have a defense if they're tried for it. If they're tried, let's say the order is to kill somebody, and that order ends up being an unlawful order and the offense is murder, and that soldier is tried for murder, that soldier can raise a defense at trial and say, obedience to orders. And as long as that order was not patently unlawful, it's a defense. No prosecution, no conviction. The murder order would most likely be patently unlawful, right? But there are a whole swath of potential orders that are not that obvious, not that obviously wrong, and expose those troops to potential criminal sanction. So one big issue here, just in the news, right, is it an unlawful order to order a drone operator to drop a missile or a bomb on a speedboat in the Caribbean? That would, at least according to most JAGs, would say that's an unlawful order because they're violating, one, the laws of war, which the administration claims it's following. And even if it's not a armed conflict, it certainly violates the Fourth Amendment and basic law of sea and domestic legal authority. So it's unlawful on multiple levels. So is that drone operator committing a crime? Or are they just obeying an order that is possibly unlawful? It gets very gray very quickly. And so it's, while we'd like to think it's a clear-cut obey lawful orders and disobey unlawful orders, on either end, it's pretty clearly obvious. But those are extreme outliers and the minority of cases. The majority of cases are in the middle where it's not quite so obvious.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you so much. Representative Gray?
Thank you, Co-Chair Kawasaki. So I just want to remind everybody that in Alaska, we have the highest per capita veteran population. Approximately a little over 10% of our population are military veterans. That's just under 60,000 military veterans. Not all of them are military retirees, but many of them are. So that is the context for, on November 18th, 2025, there was a video released of six Democratic lawmakers. One of them was U.S. Senator Mark Kelly. The words he said, I think it's really important to say them out loud. The words that he said were, "Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders. Like us, you all swore an oath to protect and defend this Constitution. Right now, the threats coming to our Constitution aren't just coming from abroad, but from right here at home." So advisor to President Trump, Stephen Miller, called the video an attempted insurrection. And then President Donald Trump declared that, quote, "the traitors to our country should be arrested and put on trial." And then he reposted suggestions that they be hanged. Secretary Pete Hegseth then ordered the Navy to look into Kelly's, quote, "potentially unlawful comments," something that he was able to do with him and not any of the other veterans in that video because he was a retiree. And so I'm just curious if, for both of our presenters, if you could comment on how common it is for military retirees to have their pay cut for things that they say as retirees. I just want to talk about how common that is to go back and cut somebody's military pay for something they said that the presidential administration disagrees with.
It's never happened that I've heard of.
Correct. It's never happened, especially because the statute itself that allows the administration to reduce retired pay is predicated on the misconduct occurring while the person was on active duty, not after they retired. He retired 14 years ago, and the entire statement that he's been investigated for relates to the statements that he made in November via the video. All the misconduct, quote-unquote misconduct, which I wanted to be clear, is not actually misconduct, happened after he retired. So the process that they're even using to consider reducing him is flawed from the very beginning. But reiterate the point, it never happens. Even if evidence came out, you know, this retiree said something the administration doesn't like before they retired, chances are, once they're retired, they're not going to be brought back to active duty to be tried by court-martial, certainly, and they're not going to have their retirement rank reduced as a consequence of that statement they made while they were on active duty.
Thanks. Two quick follow-ups. Number one, it was my understanding that he wasn't going to be court-martialed and put on any kind of trial, that it was going to be an administrative action to reduce his pay. So I want a clarification on that. And then number two, I'm just curious if both of you could comment on how this might affect the veteran population in Alaska to see a fellow veteran and retiree treated like this for saying something that, per what we've heard today, was 100% factual.
Sure. So he was initially threatened with court-martial. The initial comments from Hegseth were very clear that court-martial was on the table. Only after the Navy conducted its investigation, which I think took about a month, give or take, did Hegseth publicly say, we're going to pursue, I'm going to give you a censure, like a reprimand in writing, and I'll put it in your file, and I'm going to use that as the basis to initiate this administrative reduction for you. And the reason why he's not being prosecuted via court-martial is the same reason that he and the other five were not indicted in D.C. District Court the other day by a grand jury, because there's no evidence of actual criminal behavior. That's point number one. Point number two is my initial take is that, you know, any threat by the administration on, you know, to potentially punish retirees for their speech is incredibly dangerous. I mean, obviously, it seems to impact in a very negative way one's First Amendment rights, and that's very concerning. Now, there are statutes within the UCMJ that do limit speech, and they would, in fact, apply to retirees. For example, Article 88 of the UCMJ, contemptuous words, very vaguely explained. There's no like example list of words that you can't use or phrases you can't use. It's only been used twice in modern American military history, and never against a retiree, and only applies to officers. But theoretically, if Senator Kelly, retired captain, and now Senator Kelly, had used contemptuous words against the president or Secretary of Defense Hegseth in his personal capacity, even, that would violate the UCMJ. But I'll beat the dead horse here. What he said was not seditious, was not treason, and was not contemptuous, not conduct of becoming an officer, not prejudicial to good order and discipline, because again, he's restating the law. Now, with regard to, is this gonna chill, no pun intended, Alaskan retirees, it could. Certainly if you're a senior retiree, perhaps more rank than a lieutenant colonel has. I've said the same things that Captain retired Kelly has said on national media, the exact same words. And I feel confident saying those words because I know it's not a criminal behavior. Now, am I putting myself at risk for being essentially targeted by the administration? Perhaps. But again, I'm just a lieutenant colonel. The reason why he went after Captain retired Kelly was not because he was a captain. It was because he's a sitting senator, a sitting Democratic senator, a sitting Democratic senator who has very vocally gone against the administration since the beginning. He was a target of opportunity, and the fact that he was a retired officer gave them the perception that they could go after him on this other route. That's why they went after him. I don't think the majority of, you know, former service members, or certainly retired service members in Alaska, are at great risk of of being investigated or prosecuted by the federal administration for things that they say in public that may be divisive or may be contrary to the party line. Are they at risk? Yes, if they violate Article 88 in particular, if they're a retired officer. But again, the likelihood of them being prosecuted for it is very, very, very small.
Thank you, Mr. Maurer. Did you have any comments, Ms. Stock, before I go to the last question here?
I just thought it backfired because Senator Kelly got so much support for fighting back, you know, that it was almost like comical. Like, if you want to step in it, you know, threaten to prosecute a sitting senator for telling people what the law is, you know, it just seemed to me it was completely silly to do that, and it completely backfired as a political ploy. I don't know too many people who are actually intimidated at this point because there's so many people who are. They can't go after everybody. And if they did try to go after somebody, there would be so many people to jump in to defend them, and they'd win the case, and they get to file a national lawsuit that, and I think they've learned that now, so I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of this.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think almost everyone here has probably seen that video of the members of Congress talking about unlawful orders. You know, no one disagrees that anyone going through basic or any type of military training has received training in lawful, unlawful orders. I think the main concern about the video was not specifying, as was described by Ms. Stock. You know, sometimes enlisted soldiers, it's a little more difficult for them to know what the difference between an unlawful and lawful order is, and that can create a lot of confusion, especially in a wartime activity. Some boat strikes may or may not have. So I wanted to see, just off of conversations with Professor Maurer or Ms. Stock, what the thoughts are on specifying for a lot of soldiers all the complexities that go into the difference between a lawful and unlawful order for the wide variety of soldiers across the United States military.
Well, we did that a lot. In fact, field training, we incorporated law of war exercises into the training. And so you'd be in the field and you'd be attacking an objective, and all of a sudden there's like an enemy soldier surrendering and you have to handle that person correctly. And you would be rated on whether you complied with the law or not in handling that individual. And this is commonly part of training. Maybe they're eliminating this because they're not focusing on this woke stuff of law anymore, but throughout my training, every time we did an exercise in the field, they had a JAG officer there, and they had scenarios built in, you know, that you can't shoot the prisoner after they surrendered, and the boat scenario was often used as an example. We had PowerPoint slides with scenarios, you know, this is what you're allowed to do, this is what you're not allowed to do. They tried to keep it pretty simple, but it was always incorporated into the training that the people had to understand how to comply with the law, whether it was a civil disturbance training or whether it was infantry training, which I had happened to have a lot of infantry training because I was an infantry unit, and they would incorporate these principles into the actual training as part of the exercise, and people would get rated and graded on it, and they'd give you scenarios where you're allowed to do it here, you're not allowed to do it here. This was extremely common. Just want to emphasize that it's not like people who were just given a book and told to read it. It was part of your training in the field that you'd get rated on whether you were complying with the law when you were performing your activities, whether they were combat activities or civil disturbance training.
Yeah, and my experience echoes Ms. Stock's completely, both as a former combat engineer, platoon leader in Iraq, line officer doing Iraq missions in the first year of the Iraq War, and later as a brigade judge advocate also in Iraq, and then later as a professor at West Point, professor at the JAG School. Compliance with lawful orders is a continual point of discussion and continual point of training. And it's ultimately the commander who's got the responsibility to ensure that their troops are complying with the law, not the JAG. The JAG is ultimately an advisor, a counselor. The commander bears the responsibility to ensure that their troops are compliant. If they're not, if the commander kind of ignores that duty, they're derelict in the performance of their duties, which itself is a crime. There's that, I guess, added level of protection. The issue with the generic statement in the video, it actually makes it less compelling of a threat. makes it less likely to be a crime because it didn't mention a specific order, didn't mention the boats, didn't mention sporting ice, didn't mention riots, didn't mention Greenland, it didn't mention Trump, it didn't mention Hegseth. The context, the circumstances, I think to most observers are pretty clear that those were the concerns animating those six lawmakers. But no specific order was mentioned as being unlawful, and no order giver was mentioned as being an unlawful order giver. It might be a different case, very well could be a different case, if Kelly or any of the others had said, the order to attack boats is an unlawful order, and here's my reason why. I personally think it is, but let's say those senators said it, and said it in a way that left nothing to the imagination that they're encouraging people to disobey that order. You're in a unit that's going to deploy to the Caribbean. You're in the Navy, you're in the Marines, you're in the Air Force, you're a special operator, and you're going to be involved in these strikes. Know that those are illegal strikes, and you should be disobeying those orders. That might meet the definition of the federal sedition statute, seditious conspiracy statute that they were initially investigated under. It might constitute an Article 134 conduct prejudicial to the good order and discipline of the command. It might be conduct unbecoming an officer. It might be any number of other UCMJ offenses. So the more specific the commentary would be, the more danger those individuals would be in of violating those statutes. The fact that they left it so generic was an additional layer of protection for them.
Thank you. I'm sorry to cut you a little short. We wanted to get to the other three speakers, but I'd like to thank Mr. Maurer and Ms. Stock once again. And we're going to go ahead and move on. Before I moved on, though, I did want to say that Lieutenant Colonel Banez is online. He is one of our civilian members of the Legislative Joint Armed Services Committee, a longtime member. I just wanted to thank him for being here. We'll go ahead next. Our next speaker is Lisa Slaba. Lisa is a Master of Public Policy candidate and military spouse of 10 years. She's currently based at Eielson Air Force Base since the fall of 2021. A dedicated advocate for military personnel and their families, Lisa integrates her professional background in economic development to translate the unique demands of military life in the Alaska interior into informed policy insights for us here at the state of Alaska. Her work focuses on the vital link between family morale and mission readiness across the total force. Thanks for being here, Ms. Slaba. I'll go.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I'll go ahead and start just with a couple questions or a question and then pass it off to anybody who wants to ask. But you've been a military spouse. Part of this whole discussion and the reason why we're here today was to discuss sort of these ready to deploy orders. And although you weren't directly impacted, I'm just wanted to have an opinion on how military families might have been impacted during that time, emotionally, logistically, even though those orders were later rescinded.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki, Representative Gray, and members of the Joint Armed Services Committee for the opportunity to speak with you today. As noted, my name is Lisa Slaba. I am appearing before you today as a private citizen and a military spouse. While the perspectives I'm sharing are deeply informed by my experience within the military community, I want to be clear for the record that these comments are my own and do not reflect official policy or position of the Department of Defense, federal agency or office, any branch of the armed forces or military installation. As it pertains to your question, Senator Kawasaki, from my perspective as a spouse, we essentially live with a baseline of uncertainty because of who we decided to marry. And so when my family's timeline has changed, suddenly it has caused an immediate and intense pivot for our entire household. And so in my experience, that has created a high emotional pressure. You are mentally and heartfully preparing for a significant life change. And even though those can be rescinded or things stabilize or what have you, you can't immediately undo that emotional preparation it takes to find your rhythm again. And so I have seen firsthand how this change in timeline carries an immediate financial, physical, and mental pressure for the family, and it's a weight we carry willingly, but it is a weight nonetheless.
And maybe, Lisa, could you tell me just a little bit about, just the sense in Fairbanks? We, of course, as a Senate office representing Fort Wainwright area, got calls from family members kind of concerned, and we had to tell them we're not really the people in charge of that. I don't know exactly what ready-to-deploy orders actually are, but, you know, they were very concerned, and maybe you could just tell me how that situation sort of reverberated within the military community.
Yeah, in my observations, you know, even though my family wasn't connected, as you noted previously, I am stationed at Eielson. The military community goes into support mode almost immediately anytime we may get an inkling or a hearing of what that could look like. So we will notice a shift in energy, whether that be at the grocery store, school drop-offs just among our neighborhoods, but it's that collective sense touches all of us in some way or another, regardless of our affiliation. And so we end up quickly coordinating the logistics of different things, whether that be at home, at work, our childcare, schools. We want to make sure our kids feel safe and have the support that they need, knowing that their parent could be leaving for an undetermined amount of time. And so it just shows that as a whole, we accept it, even though we might not like it. And so knowing that we can't change it, we are still going to call and we may still ask questions about it, because we are usually seeking just more information across the board.
Thank you, Ms. Slaba. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Slaba, for being here. You know, I think there might be a perception among some folks without military service in their family that this is just sort of par for the course. You know, this is, the military is always ready to go, you know, ready to deploy. But could you perhaps contrast these kind of open-ended orders with a typical deployment where perhaps you have more lead time and more certainty about when it's going to occur or not occur?
I wouldn't be able to speak directly on that. What I can share is that, you know, there is a difference, but as you mentioned at the beginning of your statement there, or your question, is that we don't always get a lot of lead time as to whether our service member will have to leave. So in that respect, it is sometimes always ready to go at any time. You know, that is a conversation I've had at the dinner table with my husband, that he could get a phone call and he does have to go, whether that be overseas, back to the office because something happened on the installation or what have you. Our families always have to be prepared for the unknown.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Slaba. Thank you, Senator Dunbar. Representative Holland.
Right. Thank you. And just briefly, and I don't think we can go too far into this, but I'm really curious about how this has affected you and your family and other families, given the, controversy around these potential deployments. I suspect that if this was a more traditional deployment into, you know, some sort of active military activity, there's an understanding that you're going where you're sent to do the job you're asked to do. In this case, the situation has gotten much more complex. And I'm just curious if that has added a different layer of stress and uncertainty to these plans, or if it's still a matter of we go where we're sent and we'll suck it up. How has this affected you in this regard?
Thank you for that question, Representative Holland. Unfortunately, I do not feel comfortable in answering that question. Just as a military family member, like I mentioned previously, we have to be prepared and expect sometimes the worst and hope for the best.
I respect that. Thank you for your comments.
Great. Thank you, Ms. Slaba. We're going to have to move on to our next testifier because there's only 20 minutes left and two more people on deck. But thank you for your testimony. Thanks for being online today, and we'll see you next week.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Next in line, we do have Ms. Brittany Smart. Brittany is going to speak to us about the Alaska Defense Forum, which some members of this committee have been on, and I hope that we see everybody up in Fairbanks this August. Brittany is the Senior Advisor for Defense Community and Research at the University of Alaska Fairbanks' Geophysical Institute, where she works at the intersection of civilian communities, defense missions, and applied research. She's the Director of the Alaska Defense Forum and serves on the board of directors of the Association of Defense Communities. She also serves on ADC's Federal Outreach and Advisory Council and was recognized as a Great American Defense Community Champion for 2024-2025. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Senator Kawasaki. And wow, that was a mouthful. My apologies. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak about the Alaska Defense Forum. It is an annual event, one that I am incredibly proud of, that brings together defense community and business partners to talk about some of those shared challenges, priorities, and opportunities in order to move forward together. When we think through the roles that communities play in terms of transportation, logistics, workforce, childcare, housing, a lot of those issues are readiness issues for our installations and our missions, and yet are the responsibilities of our local communities. This is an opportunity for us to come together once a year, highlight where we can work together, what we need to continue working on, and celebrate the accomplishments that we've had. I've been very pleased to have the partnership with the JASC over the years to participate in this event. I think it's a great opportunity to network and connect with some of our Pentagon partners that come and support this event every year. I'm happy to answer any questions, but before I move on, the save the date is the very last week of August. So it is the 24th, 25th, 26th of August, and we look forward to having you all here. The event kicks off on Monday, and generally we have tours that happen that day, and then the forum itself happens on the Tuesday and Wednesday, and we follow it up with post-event activities with things along the lines of the JASC side meetings and stuff that we've had in the past. So look forward to answering any questions. I hope to see you all up in Fairbanks here soon, later on this summer, and look forward to any questions you have.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smart. We definitely will be up back home, and we definitely will make sure that that invitation is extended to other members of this Joint Armed Services Committee, and actually a lot of the legislators, I think, are very interested in participating this summer. I've got a question here from Co-Chair Representative Gray.
Thank you, Co-Chair Kawasaki. I just wanted to say to Brittany Smart that this year's Alaska Defense Forum was just incredible. It was a really, really amazing event. I'm very grateful for your hard work and all of the organizers, because it was just, I mean, for people who didn't go this year, I mean, Representative Divert was there. It was really a world-class event with amazing speakers, and I learned so much. So thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thanks. Maybe you could tell us just a little bit, before we entertain our last speaker, a little bit more about what you do with the Association of Defense Communities, the federal national group.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Alaska Defense Forum is actually modeled off of the Association of Defense Community National Events. There's two primary events that they have. One is called the National Summit that is held in DC that is more policy-based, and the other one is called Installation Innovation Forum, and that is really learning about case studies from across the country, how are installations and communities working together, and I look to those two events in order to shape what the Alaska Defense Forum looks like. The Association of Defense Communities is an organization that mirrors what our goals are for the Alaska Defense Forum, where it brings together military, business, and community partners to address challenges from across the nation. It's a great opportunity to learn more about what other communities are doing and help drive policies that support our local communities to address the installation and readiness needs of our local military partners.
Great. Thank you. Representative Holland.
Great. Thank you. It's good to see you again. I'm just curious where you feel like things are at with the relationship of the NSEN and the MAC, and the development that we had seen with the innovation-related partnerships between the installations and the community, looking at dual use and economic development opportunities. I know we did quite a bit of work a few years ago. It seems like things kind of stalled out. Is there a way we can understand where that's going, and as we look at the next defense forum, is there going to be an opportunity to put some energy into that area of joint mission challenge and potential economic development?
Well, I'll start with your last comment there. The purpose of the Alaska Defense Forum is to really highlight those opportunities of economic development and looking at what those shared opportunities are. In terms of the AMAC, I have not been involved in those conversations, so I'm not able to speak to that, and I look forward to seeing that, that effort move forward and get some traction. I'd love to highlight any of those efforts at the Defense Forum and provide a stage to share any updates that we potentially may have there. In terms of innovation, I think we've really gotten, we've made quite a bit of progress. And one of the downsides is it's due to tightened budgets, right? So a lot of our partners are having to look to our local community partners as a way to help still meet their readiness and mission needs with further tightening budgets. So that has been really successful for us from the community standpoint. There's also a competitive infrastructure program with the Office of Local Defense Community Cooperation, OLDCC, known as DCIP, the Defense Community Infrastructure Program. And Alaska has done very, very well with that program. Right now we have 6 active projects. 3 of them were awarded in this last year, in this last cycle. And it's just been a phenomenal opportunity for us to address some of our local infrastructure challenges that also meet and address some of the installation and mission readiness challenges that we have. For this last funding cycle, we got 30% of the overall awards. There were 10 awarded projects, and Alaska got 3 of them just with this last funding cycle. So I think that the role Alaska plays in our national defense strategy really positions us into an opportunity to really take advantage of these partnership opportunities, as long as we're open to the conversations and coming to the table as a willing and equal partner in the conversations.
Great, thank you.
Great, thank you very much for joining us, Ms. Smart. We just have 10 minutes left, but we do have one last presentation. That's from one of my favorites, Tammy Perot, if Tammy would join us. Tammy became the Northwest Region Defense State Liaison Officer in 2018. In this role, she serves as a point of contact between the Department of Defense and the state governments, working to strengthen coordination on defense policy issues and matters affecting service members, their families, and host communities. Prior to joining the DSLO, she worked in both corporate and nonprofit sectors in public policy development and advocacy. Ms. Perot is a U.S. combat veteran, Army combat veteran, who served with the 411th Civil Affairs Battalion. And we'd like to give you the dais.
Senator Kawasaki, Co-Chair Gray, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I have a few slides, but we have limited time, so I'll just go ahead and get started. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you also for taking time to understand the lived experience of our military families today. It means a lot to me as a military family member and as a veteran, and it helps inform your committee when you have the opportunity to make decisions around state legislation that can support our military families. And that's what I'm just going to briefly talk to you about today. Here on the screen, you see the state policy priorities, which our office supports for 2026. And so our office, as part of the Department of War, identifies policies that will support our military families. None of these policies are specific to Alaska. We look for policies that are going to be effective in every state where we have military members stationed all 50 states and our territories. And I'd like to highlight on top that the state of Alaska already has a military spouse employment preference done by Representative Nelson. You already allow for us to provide off-installation child care. You allow for, you have an excellent military community representation on state boards and councils, and in your statehood act, you have maintained jurisdiction of our federal installations so we can share the work that is required for jurisdictional issues. I'd like to highlight there in the yellow some areas that we can continue to work together on. And I am here in the building all day tomorrow, and I'm always available for you to call or email or come up and spend time with you in Juneau to talk about any of these things. The first is helping our families with special education needs. Alaska has already taken the very important step in that if there is a due process hearing, that does not fall to a family to have to support the cost of a due process hearing. In the state of Alaska, that falls to the district. We oftentimes have families that just cannot be part of a due process hearing because of the financial burden. However, we are asking states to look carefully at their IEP and 504 transition processes and do their best to utilize those previous assessments and evaluations that have been done and get the services, comparable services for students as they move. Our education policy and implementation information enhancements priority, this is really tightening up some things that outside of the Military Child Education Compact, tightening up the Purple Star program, improving policies that support our military children. You have a bill introduced on this in the legislature, House Bill 256 by Representative Stapp. I look forward to talking more about that legislation with you all in the future. That bill also addresses open enrollment flexibility. If there's open enrollment in a state, we often find that our military families aren't able to take advantage of those policies if they are in place, and we'd like to ensure that there are specific provisions to support military families who oftentimes aren't here during the open enrollment time frame. So please consider that when you're talking about open enrollment. And then finally, solutions for military homeschool. We, around the education piece, we appreciate the broad homeschool opportunities that for our military children. Military families homeschool at about 3 times the rate of traditional families outside of the military, so much higher homeschool rates. And just one little clarification we'd love to have made is just clarifying that JROTC is open for homeschoolers who may not live in a district where JROTC is available so that they can go to any district. You have some great language about allowing for athletics, but just that little clarity around JROTC would be helpful. I'm going to talk about one of my favorite topics and a topic that this legislature moved forward today, and that's occupational licensure compacts. Thank you very much to Co-Chair Gray for moving forward the social work compact out of the House today. Occupational licensure compacts are a priority for the Department of Defense because we see them as the best way for a military spouse to transition their license and have quality licensure portability. Congress charged our office with working with states to implement occupational licensure compacts. Not all occupational licensure compacts are the same, and this state has recently made a commitment to support several occupational licensure compacts in the Rural Health Initiative grant. So the federal government, we really see how these compacts can help not only our military families, but also our families in rural areas. We would encourage you to just continue to work on the adoption of compacts, which are supported by these occupations, and continue to adopt these for the benefit of our military families. Here in front of you is a list of current legislation that we are supporting. Again, House Bill 256 has lots of wonderful content and policy in it that we would like to move forward, strengthening Purple Star, strengthening the services around for our military children, and then a list of compacts and licensure policy that we are looking to support this legislative session. We would appreciate the opportunity to talk to any of you about those and to talk about how we can move those through here in the 2026 session. So, stand by for your questions. Thank you very much.
Oh, great. Thank you. Thanks a lot for being here. And you've been a real fixture here in the Capitol, providing us some great information. I'll just say that, I mean, a lot of the legislation that we've seen come through, specifically helping the families at Fort Wainwright, have been because you've driven it. And I just wanted to thank you for being here. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Perot, for being here. If we go back to that previous slide there about the occupational compacts, so there's a discussion happening now, you're probably aware, at the Rural Health Transformation Fund, and this is part of it. But another part of it is scope of practice, and there are at least two pieces of scope of practice legislation that are currently going forward. Mm-hmm. It seems like that would have similar support, given that, you know, when folks are going from a take a physician's assistant, going from a state where they have broader scope of practice, coming to Alaska and being restricted, that also would be maybe deleterious to their career. And so do you take any position on the scope of practice bills?
Through the chair to Senator Dunbar, we have not historically taken a position on scope of practice bills. However, we understand that scope of practice is really, you know, how a state determines it, and there are certain things that sometimes we can look at that's and we can say, okay, is the scope of practice in the state adequate or appropriate or aligned to ensure that it supports this compact, right? So scope of practice can be different in different states, and the state can still have that compact, the licensure component of it, but sometimes states' scope of practice is written in a way that it may not align or may not be able to align. So we don't take a position on scope of practice. We support any enabling legislation that is necessary in order to establish a compact in the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you. Let's see. Are there any more questions for Tammy? And Tammy will be around.
Yes. One last thing, follow up to Ms. Smart. This is a picture of one of the tours prior to the Alaska Defense Forum this past year. And so if you want to go on wonderful tours like this, I also encourage you to join me in Fairbanks in August. So thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and thank you for being so welcoming. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ms. Peralt. And I have not yet been to the CLEAR new Space Force station, so I should definitely try to do that. Before we leave, I wanted to see if there were any last questions. I believe everybody is still online. Co-Chair Gray.
Thank you so much, Senator Kawasaki. And this is a question for Dan Maurer. I want to just prep his question. He was prepared to speak about the 11th Airborne's ready to deploy orders to Minneapolis. But because, and I'm very grateful to DOD and the Pentagon for standing down those orders, but I think a lot of us probably heard from our constituents concern about that deployment. They were afraid that it could be redirected to Greenland. And so one of the questions that he was prepared to ask, answer that we didn't ask him was, if how would it have been feasible for those folks to have been redirected to Greenland if the President of the United States had decided that's what he wanted to do?
Mr. Maurer.
Thank you. So the answer in short is yes, it would have been feasible. If you look at the mission statement of the 11th Airborne Division, it's essentially committing to warfare in places like Greenland. Thankfully, they're not there. The idea is that theoretically they could deploy to Russia or any other Arctic locale to fight our nation's wars as a conventional Army unit. So it was concerning when they received ready-to-deploy orders to Minnesota because, again, for the reasons that we've discussed all night, it's unconventional to put active-duty forces in that role where they might be supporting federal ICE agents when the Insurrection Act has not been invoked, or even when it has been invoked, very rare to do that sort of mission, and for which they were not really trained to do. As Ms. Stock alluded to and described in pretty fair detail, active duty troops are not well trained for that kind of law enforcement role at all. The ready-to-deploy order is simply it's a standard order. It basically get ready to go in case we need you. And it generally entails, it's a little bit different, I think, unit by unit, and perhaps with some specificity from the Pentagon, but generally it means make sure that your individuals are ready to go. Make sure their wills are updated, their powers of attorney are straight, they've updated their insurance, they might have to get called back off of leave. Vehicles are prepped and ensure that they're mission ready in the motor pool. They might even be moved to a railhead or a shipping yard in case they have to get pushed to a foreign port of debarkation. So that's not, the ready deploy order is simply that. It would be unusual, but not, if not illegal, to redirect them from Minnesota and go to Greenland. It may even been a subterfuge. I don't know, and no, I don't think anyone really knows in the public if the Minnesota mission was really just cover for a potential deployment to Greenland. I don't know the answer to that. But if they had been directed to go, the president is well within his authority as commander-in-chief to do that. Again, it's an active-duty unit that's literally built to do combat operations in an environment like Greenland. Again, the policy choice behind doing that is questionable and debatable, but the legality of it, in terms of simply, does he have the authority to move the unit from one kind of mission to another is absolutely true. The legality of an actual deployment to Greenland to invade, occupy, annex, or seize any part of it, that's a whole nother legal question, and the answer to that is it's unlawful under both domestic law and international law. But that's a different question from whether the president can redirect a unit from one place to another place. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for being here tonight, you and Ms. Tuck and all of our presenters. And I don't want to take it away from Co-Chair Kawasaki, but since I made you come back online, and I know you're on the East Coast, and it's very late at night, and I appreciate you staying on. Thank you so much, Mr. Maurer.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Maurer. I'll just say that we got inquiries from Danish journalists about this potential. I hadn't even thought about it, but you know, the 11th Airborne is one of the fighting forces, a superior fighting force for especially Arctic, in the Arctic, and we hope that they're not engaged with our allies, of course, and I didn't think about it until the people had written us and talked to us about this potential for a threat happening. And so I really do appreciate that comment, Terry. Appreciate you being here today, Mr. Maurer. I wanted to also thank Margaret Stock, Lisa Slaba, Brittany Smart, and, of course, Tammy Peralt for being here. I wanted to thank the other members of the Joint Armed Services Committee who are online and here in the room for entertaining us today during this committee hearing. The next committee hearing has not been scheduled, but we will definitely have a committee hearing with the rest of the commanders of the Alaska Command and other folks. So without any other business before the committee, we will go ahead and adjourn at 7:06.